You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. I really hope that you got some great recommendations from our bumper recommendation special last month, which is available to listen back to over on Radio Reverb and on all good podcast platforms. Just search for the Brighton Book Club. So I am taking a little break from the show this month, and I'm delighted that my wonderful friends Victoria and Cindy, who are the founders of Brighton's Real Writers Circle, have taken the reins and recorded today's episode. It is a joy to listen to. They speak to members of the circle about what they're writing and the books that have influenced them. And they talk to member of the Real Writers Circle, Samuel Burr, about his new book, The Fellowship of the Puzzle Makers. He's also joined by his editor, and it's a fascinating conversation. So I really hope you enjoy the show, and make sure you follow what the Real Writers Circle are up to. And you can find them at www.realwriterscircle.com. Enjoy the show.
Hello, I'm Victoria Robson, a journalist and novelist.
And I'm Cindy Epperton, memoirist, novelist and effectiveness coach.
We are friends and co-founders of Real Writers Circle, a Brighton-based community of writers who come together monthly to talk about writing, share work and expertise, and have fun in the company of other writers, whatever their writing goals.
We believe writers benefit from the company and support of other writers as they navigate their creative lives with all the challenges and opportunities that surface, and that we have much to share and learn from each other.
And we're thrilled to be on Radio Reverb and to have the opportunity to extend the circle to you in this episode of Brighton Book Club. In this show, we'll be talking to members of Real Writers Circle about their writing, their favourite books, and the impact those books have had on their work.
And we are delighted to catch up with Real Writers Circle member Samuel Burr and its editor, Charlotte Mercel, to talk about Sam's debut novel, The Fellowship of the Puzzle Makers, out in May. We hope you enjoy spending some time with us and feel part of the circle.
We have members in the circle who write across all genres of fiction, from dystopian YA to cozy crime to historical suspense, and narrative non-fiction writers and also memoirists. I'm very intrigued to hear a selection of favourite books from our writers and how those books have influenced their writing. So joining Cindy and I to discuss our favourite books and how they've influenced our writing are Circle members Jackie Mendoza, Tia Byrne and Kate Marsh. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
So glad you're here. Jackie, I wondered if we could start with you and ask you to introduce yourself and share a little bit about what you're writing.
So my name is Jackie Mendoza and I write YA fantasy. I'm working on a work in progress at the moment, which was shortlisted for the Peters Fraser and Dunlop Queer Fiction Prize earlier this year. And I'm bringing it sort of like close to querying submission. Well, it's a coming of age story about a young girl who is brought up in a reimagined Philippines during its colonization by Spain. And the big question is, I mean, well, how would I describe it? I'd describe it as Shadow and Bone meets In the Shadow of the Wolf Queen by way of the Testaments. And I'd say the shout line is, on the island of Catamon, boys are destined to lead and girls are destined to serve them. So will 15-year-old Amelia have the courage to defy and challenge years of beliefs and traditions? So there's a fantastical and magical element to it as well. I mean, it's very much a coming of age story.
So Kia, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're currently writing?
Yes, hello. So I have tried my hand at lots of different genres. I'm currently writing what's probably best described as a golden age murder mystery set in the late 1920s. And really enjoying that. But in the past, I've written historical fiction going much further back to as far back as the Norman era, and that's a dual time slip with Victorian. I have written contemporary, I've tried my hand at urban fantasy, I've tried more literary fiction. So although I haven't yet been published as an author, I am a journalist in my day job, I've got 4 unpublished novels under my belt, and I'm now working on one that I hope is going to be published.
And Kate?
I'm Kate Marsh. I write short stories, and they're mainly satirical, really. They are the way I see the world, really, what the world is like now, and just taken to a slightly ludicrous level, slightly more ludicrous than it really is. And I'm very interested in the way that technology and social media has affected the way that we live.
Yeah.
And that's reflected in what I write.
Cindy, what are you working on at the moment?
Well, I think, as you all know, I've written a memoir, and as a result of one of our Real Writer sessions with Marnie, I'm going to, in the new year, do a rewrite on that piece of work. One, because I've become to believe in it, but also I now know someone who can help me actually fix it in the way that it needs to be fixed. But I'm also now, before the end of the year, trying to get to the end of my edits on what I've described to the Circle members as a psychological thriller. It's called Beware of Arkansas, so it's a novel. I'm now on my second proper rewrite, so I've spent months on edits. And the story, I know you see this written, and I've heard of it in conceptual terms, that the story and the characters reveal themselves. But that's what's happened. I mean, that is actually what's happened now. So I've got a different story that's coming out of the story I started out to tell. And it's a thrilling process, really. So that's where I'm at with it at the moment. So I'm trying to sort of eliminate the obvious and the irrelevant, anything that doesn't serve the story's now purpose. And I'm trying to add meaning. And that's the kind of emotional part of it, the depth in it. And I think we said at one of our events when we were in the artist studio that it's like trying to paint a portrait and then adding the little bits at the end, getting the background right. And I think I'm just at the end where I'm trying to add the little bits that make it into some sort of thing that's attractive to read. So yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I never thought I'd say I'm really enjoying editing.
Yeah, I had a similar experience actually with the book that I'm currently working on. So this is my, I'm yet to be published, and this is my second novel. It's a romance, enemies to lovers, small town romance, set in Maine in a coastal town during the summer, where a war correspondent comes to town to sell a cottage she's inherited. And from there, things continue. And I'm in my final editing stage of that, and really enjoying kind of smoothing it out and correcting a few plot points and just making sure it's consistent and things work, because there's things that I've missed. I'm sharpening it up, basically.
Yes.
And that feels really fun and really good to be doing, and to know that the work exists and I'm just kind of making it better.
I love the sound of it.
So, it'd be great to hear about people's favourite books. So I'll ask you about your favourite books, and then we'll talk about how they've influenced you. Perhaps Kia, we can start with you this time. I'm very curious to know, that someone who's so skilled at writing across genres, what are your favourite books and why?
Well, so it might not surprise you that, I mean, there's a long list really, but I've narrowed it down to 3. The first one is Magic Faraway Tree. I'm not going to talk about this for very long. I know Enid Blyton is really problematic, but that's probably the first book I ever read when I was, I don't know, 5. And it's just the bit when the children find this magical wood and they hear the trees whispering to one another, saying, "Wisher, wisher." And then they have to leap over a ditch. And it's that sort of process of leaping into the magical world. And for me, that says a lot about story and how, you know, that's what I love about story, that it allows us to escape from our everyday life into this magical world. So I had to mention that. And then when I was, so I'm going quite way back with my choices, but when I was maybe 12, 13, I was really into Agatha Christie. I read literally every Agatha Christie. And I got to the point where I could spot the murderer pretty early on in the book. But Evil Under the Sun is one of my very favourite Agatha Christie's. All of her books are very short and sparse. There's not a huge amount of, I mean, there is description, but they are short books, and yet she manages to convey so much in not many words. And Evil Under the Sun is set on a remote island off the coast of Devon. There's a glamorous, bitchy woman who's stolen, you know, another woman's husband, it seems, who ends up getting murdered. I love that setting. I love the glamour of the setting. Her plotting is amazing, and it all makes perfect sense when you get to the end. So I had to mention that one. More on a more pretentious note, I was an English Lit student, and I had to mention Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse. I love Virginia Woolf. I think this has to be my favourite one of her novels. And I think what I really love about To the Lighthouse is its sense of place. And I think that's something that's quite important to me in my writing. A lot of my writing is set where I live in Lewes, in East Sussex. And Virginia Woolf lived just down the road from here. And nominally, To the Lighthouse is set in the Isle of Skye, which is a place I know. My mother's Scottish, and I went to Edinburgh University, and I holidayed on the Isle of Skye myself. I don't think it's a very convincing portrayal of the Isle of Skye, because the weather's far too good. my memory of the Isle of Skye is that it mainly sort of buckets down with rain 99% of the time. So I'm pretty sure, and you know, it's well documented, that it's really based on her childhood holidays in near St. Ives, in a house called Talent House, I think it was. And it was overlooking the bay, where they could see the Gadrevi Lighthouse. And there is just this wonderful sense of place in the novel. One thing that I volunteered in the garden at Charleston Farmhouse, where the Vanessa Bell, Virginia's sister, lived. And when I was first there, there were these beautiful purple clematis climbing up the walls. And it rang a bell with me. And I went back and I looked into the lighthouse, and she talks about the Jack, it's a more old-fashioned word, but basically that's what they used to call purple clematis in the 1920s. I think it's Jackamana. And so she sort of weaves in these details of flowers, of, you can feel looking out to the lighthouse. I was on my dog walk this morning before I did the podcast, and it's a beautiful day here. And I thought, actually, we've got our own version of the lighthouse. We've got the New Haven Incinerator, but it's there. It's, you know, it's like a sort of totem. You know, what would happen if you got to that golden point? I mean, you'd probably be in a very smelly part of New Haven. But and of course, towards the end of To the Lighthouse, they do get there, and it's not quite what they expected. The reason I've chosen Virginia Woolf and Agatha Christie is that I find this division between popular fiction and literary fiction quite problematic, because yeah. For me, fiction is just about what I enjoy. You know, it does tell me something about the human condition, but I think Agatha Christie can do that as much as Virginia Woolf, if in a different way. And I sort of hope in my writing that somehow I can marry the two.
Pate, what about you? What's your favourite books?
Well, probably my favourite book is The Magician's Assistant by Ann Patchett, which is, I love Ann Patchett's writing anyway, but this is the book that strikes the strongest chord with me. I can read it any number of times and it still touches me very deeply. It's nothing like what I write. I wish I could write like her, but I can't. And I think that's one of the reasons I love her writing so much, is that I can escape into it. I can't begin to fathom how she finds her way of describing places and emotions and relationships. This particular book is a book all about love and yearning and being left behind. It's about leaving home, about finding promised land that is different for different people, and about family and love and different kind, all kinds of different love, family love and queer love and found family, and somehow manages to weave them all together and has so much heart and so much grace in it, that yes, I recommend it to anybody who just wants to read about being human. But probably the writer who influences me most, and it sounds very pretentious to say it, is Jane Austen, because she writes about the world that she lived in and makes it funny. And that's what I try to do with my stories. Mm-hmm. And Persuasion is my favourite Jane Austen book, but all her books really illustrate the kind of lessons I learn from her about writing about the society you live in, like not punching down, like making fun of the people who are in the higher positions, who are in positions of wealth or power, who are pretentious. And it's also, it's so interesting how economics drives everything in Jane Austen's books. They're people read them as romances, and they are romances, but the way the society works, and she really gets to the point of this, it's very, very clear, is all about money. It's if you haven't got money, you are not going to get where you want to be, that you are always going to be striving for something that you might not be able to get, and chasing, people are always chasing after money, after influence, after prestige. And it's, I really find it interesting, but in Persuasion particularly, looking at Anne Elliot, the heroine's family, her father, who's very vain of his position as a baronet, and her older sister, and just seeing parallels between them and the way that they worship Lady Dalrymple, who is this very ridiculous kind of high-born cousin of theirs. And it just, I can see it on Instagram. I can see people running after these influencers and wanting to bask in their reflected glory. And I can see so many parallels between the society that she lived in. People don't change. People are just people. And I find her way of looking at life very, very inspiring and very funny.
And Jackie, come to you. What are your favourite books?
So my favourite books, it's funny, when I was thinking about it, I sort of saw an actual thread that was going through everything. And that was actually character. And how, for me, when I'm reading something, character is so important. So the three that I selected, well, I mean, the first one, inevitably, epic fantasy, and that's Samantha Shannon's The Priory of the Orange Tree. And that, I mean, it's a huge book. It's a very, very big book. But what I love about it is that literally for me, it's almost like a masterclass in how to write epic fantasy and how to carry it off in a really big, huge way. Because inevitably, you've got a whole plethora of characters and locations. But the thing that I found amazing was the fact that, you know, it is such an investment in a book. It really is such an investment. But then at the same time, you know, you read your way through it, and it's like that sense for me, I didn't want it to end, even though it was huge. I did not want it to end. And particularly in terms of the actual characters too, you know, having spent however long reading, you know, even coming towards the end, I found myself like slowing down because I didn't want it to end, and I didn't want to see these characters, like, you know, end in a sense. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I found absolutely fascinating. And you know, often I sort of say to myself, oh, my goodness, if only I could, I need to write, I would love to write character in that way, to the extent that they really do live with you. The second book is Life After Life, Kate Atkinson. And it's funny because I actually came across that initially through the BBC TV series a couple of years ago. And I remember thinking then, as I was watching it, I mean, already, yes, being drawn into the story, into the characters, but then for sort of thinking the technique that's used, I sort of thought, how on earth do you pull that off as a narrative? And so that's what actually drew me to actually read the book, because I sort of thought, yeah, the TV series gets away with it quite well. And I thought, how are you going to do that as a writer? And I think I probably sort of like started reading it, so like a bit sort of like, a bit cynically, sort of thinking, how are you going to do it? And I just, oh my God, I was just blown away. And again, the thing that got me with that was the technique, but also the fact that obviously she's like playing around with the whole idea of narrative and story and you know, what's real, what's not. But the characters as well. I mean, despite the technique that she uses in the narrative, you still have this connection to the characters. And those were two things that really came through to me. Plus as well, the idea, the theme of it being, if you were able to live your life again, what would you change? And I think it was, again, from a psychological perspective, looking at the characters and the main characters particularly, and the choices that they've made in the different versions, I think, and bearing in mind as well, the backdrop of the time as well. Yeah, I thought that was, it was fascinating. And then more recently, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Because again, my goodness, character-wise, beautiful character, so wonderfully written, in a sense, so cinematic. And that's what I loved about it. It was just that total connection with the characters. And again, getting towards the end of the book, and it was one of those books that I haven't, for a long while, actually read a book in almost like in just a week or under a week, because literally I just had to read and read and read and read. And that was the thing that really got me about that. I sort of thought, my God, I've not felt that for a very long time. But also in terms of how I felt about the characters. And sometimes I also judge like what I read by how emotive. I mean, I don't cry easily. Mm-hmm. So the fact that a story can actually make me, or even relationships between characters can make me cry, again, that for me is, yeah, it just hits me here. And that's what I loved about Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow, because it was just like, it was beautiful. And inevitably as well, the style of it, the cinematic style. And of course, I wasn't surprised that, yeah, I mean, the rights were sold really quickly, because inevitably it will make a really good film as well.
I love that book. And I know that it's a favourite of Cindy's as well. So what are your favourites? Does that feature among them, Cindy?
Well, yeah, it's such a great question, this one, isn't it? What's your favourite book? It just keeps on making you think all the time. But like Kia, I had to kind of just get it down to a short list. I couldn't just do the one. I'm going to just talk about one, but the ones that were on the short list for me were the first book that I voluntarily read. So when you have to read at school, and I quite like English Lit and all that, but when I actually took a book and read it myself, and I was never the same again, and that book was My Family and Other Animals by Gerald Durrell. And although I think it must have been written in the 60s, and it was, even when I read it, quite dated, but it was simple. And the sense of place and the sense of character and the observation from various different angles, I just thought it was wonderful. And I've returned to it many times over the years, and in fact have read there's a chapter 10, and where there's an old lady in bed, and the Gerald Durrell, when he's a young boy, comes and visits her, and he sits on the bed, and he's frightened of it, but she tells him that she talks to the roses, and he starts talking to the roses, and the roses start to kind of come out, and this, it's just beautiful. So My Family and Other Animals. I also, my shortlist is The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. It's written by an American author called Carson McCullers. And it's about two brothers, one who is an accountant, wears a white suit, very smart, and he looks after his brother, who's disabled and has got learning difficulties. And they move to town where the guy in the white suit can work. And they meet all these characters and they talk to them. And they each character is given a chapter on how they feel about this couple. And the brother who's disabled is quite difficult. He kind of has a meltdown in a restaurant and he's messy with his food and or he goes missing and all sorts of trouble. And right at the end of the book, you get the point of view from the brother with the white suit. And he hasn't been any of the things that those people thought he was to them. He just loved his brother. That's the only reason he did everything. La Terre, by Emile Zola. Lots of the Emile Zola books did actually save my life at a certain time, knowing that other things were happening to other people. And then Pride and Prejudice, which I thought was probably the biggest surprise of my life. I read it about 10 years ago because I was so resistant to the idea of that it was all about bonnets and everything. And I thought, I've just seen it so many times on television. I'm not going to be interested. Oh, wow, how wrong was I? And the thing I took away from Pride and Prejudice was that it's okay not to get on with all your relatives. it actually gave me permission to do that. And I agree with everything that Kate said in her analysis of her. But the book that I've chosen to say is my favourite book relative to its impact on my writing is a Joan Didion book called The Year of Magical Thinking. Now, Joan Didion is another American writer, and she was married to a writer, John Donne, for 40 years, and they had an adopted daughter called Quintana. Quintana got flu that turned into pneumonia and then sepsis and was on a life support machine. They were going back and forth to the hospital. And one night when they came home from one of the hospital visits, they sat at their New York apartment and they had some soup. It was about 6 o'clock in the evening. And as he lifted his spoon to his mouth, he had a heart attack and fell to the floor and died. But in the book, the thing that, I mean, it seems as if it's a book about grief, and it is. And in fact, I'll read what she says that it's about. She says, this powerful book is Didion's attempt to make sense of, and these are her words, the weeks and then months that cut loose any fixed idea I ever had about death, about illness, about marriage and children and memory, about the shallowness of sanity and about life itself. Now, it's a great book on the subject of that, but the reason I love it so much is that what the magical thinking means is that after a while, after some months, she starts to conform to the outside world's idea of how she should be recovering and going through a grief process. About time that you did this and about time that you did that. But at home, she's living a very different life. She's still cooking for two. She's making cups of tea for two in the morning and she's talking to him all the time as if he's there. She refuses to accept that he's gone. And her other idiosyncrasy is that almost every other page or every other chapter, she's saying, and then I went to the research. So she researches everything. She tries to find out everything she can about his condition, about her condition, about grief. And I think we as writers kind of share that. Go to the research, have a look and go back over it. But so overall, in summary, the thing about that's affected my writing is really the fact that it's that difference, the incongruity between an external life and an interior life. And you usually do it by observation. It's very rare for a writer to be able to describe that themselves. I also saw Vanessa Redgrave perform it, and it was amazing in terms of its sort of, and I just knew after I'd read this and seen that I'd never be the same again. So yeah, that's, I think, yeah, that incongruity in character is one of the things that always gets into my writing. How we present, what we say, how we know ourselves or don't, and actually what's going on behind that. And she covers it so beautifully, really, that what drives us. So, yeah, that's really affected my writing. And I like to get a little bit of Joan Didion, if I can, into my novels. Victoria, tell me about your favourite books and how they've impacted your writing.
The two books that came immediately to mind were The Poisonwood Bible by Barbara Kingsolver and The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. And both those books are epic and tragic family dramas that take place in very specific settings, that both those places are very foreign to me, and they have themes of colonialism, foreignness. But I guess most poignantly, they are stories told in large part through the eyes of children. And there's sort of their innocence about the book, where, and this disconnect between the innocence of those children and the world that they're navigating, which is full of adult mistakes, poor choices, consequences. And so I went back for the purposes of this podcast to have a look and just have a little refresh and remind myself of the plot. And I realized that there's just, in terms of the plot of those books, I didn't remember half of it. And I was reading through thinking, oh, did that happen? Did that happen? Yes, I remember that. And I think I had forgotten kind of large chunks of the story, but it's the feeling of those books. Both writers are incredibly immersive writers. Like, I'll read anything by Barbara Kingsolver. I've got Demon Copperhead on my to be read pile as well. And there's something about the quality of their writing that sucks you right in. And I think partly that in these books to do with the childlike point of view, which takes you right in. They don't skate across the surface, and they're very specific in their setting. So in my work, I try to be really specific about the detail of place. So my romance, so although it's a completely different genre, I try to be really specific about the types of trees there are in Maine and the colour of the sky and the you know, the quality of the rain. And I think that's the immersive quality that I strive for in my writing. So I'm interested actually to ask how, how Virginia Woolf and Agatha Christie, how their style or their themes have, how they come alive in your work.
Well, I certainly wouldn't pretend, or, you know, that I'm a patch on either of them. It's quite interesting what Cindy was just saying about all that interior stuff. Going back to the Lighthouse, the first couple of chapters, I think there's about three lines of dialogue, and so there's a mother, this mother of a large family who is based on Virginia Woolf's own mother, and a small boy who's about six, and he's cutting out pictures from a magazine which he's going to colour in, and he really wants to go to the lighthouse, and the mother says something like, oh, it might be fine enough to go to the lighthouse tomorrow. And then there are pages and pages of who she is, why she's saying this, because she wants to make her son feel better. She knows that's what he wants to hear, and how he loves her for that. And then her father comes in. I mean, it's very polarized between the masculine and the feminine. The father comes in and he says, there's no chance of going to the lighthouse tomorrow. And the little boy, I mean, what you were saying, she gets right into the mind of the six-year-old child, and she says, if there was a poker nearby, he would have picked it up and beat his father to death with it. You know, really strong emotion, because the father doesn't say what he thinks his son wants to hear. And then a little bit later, the mother says again, but I think it might be, you know, fine enough to go to the lighthouse tomorrow. And it's just all the emotions of these people, and really sort of complex emotions. And also, I mean, she carries on to do this in The Waves, but it's like that ebb and flow of emotion. And I think, she addresses that complexity of human emotion, that right from a really early age, we all have feelings that are coming and going and changing and aren't consistent. And I think that it's really important to, you know, it's emotion. If you can make people feel something in your writing, that for me would be wonderful. If I could, in something I wrote, if I could capture a real emotion and people recognize it. Agatha Christie, I just think she's the most phenomenal plotter. And I think when I started writing, and I think what's the reason that my earlier novels didn't get published is I just started with that feeling, and I was having a lovely time writing, and it was all exciting, but I didn't really plot. Whereas what I've learned to do, I wouldn't say I'm on the plotter pantser, you know, dichotomy. I wouldn't say I'm total plotter, but I think to give yourself a really solid framework within which to then explore, actually, for me, I think that improves my writing. So from Agatha Christie, I'm getting the plotting, I'm getting the twist. I love the way that, I mean, when I said that I learned to spot who the murderer was, it was because it was always somebody who was not only unlikely, but also slightly out of the picture. And, you know, I think that's how the best twists work.
Kate, you mentioned Jane Austen being a huge influence on your writing, particularly Persuasion. What is it about her writing that you either aspire or you carry into your work?
I think it's very, obviously very aspirational, because she's a genius. But it's the lightness of touch that I really aspire to. It is the amount of understanding of character that is under the skin that you don't notice because you're laughing or because you're following the romantic storyline, that you're taken in by how well she writes, and you don't realize what she's saying underneath, but you get it anyway. But so she's extremely subtle. My writing, I don't think is anywhere near as subtle as that, but it's what I would love to be able to do, to make people laugh, to make them enjoy the story that they're reading and not realize really until afterwards what it is that they've learned and what it is that they are now looking at differently because they've read it. That's kind of what I get out of reading Jane Austen. It's hugely enjoyable, but it is also, it tells me an enormous amount about the society that she lived in and the constraints that she lived within. And that's really something that I admire.
And Anne Pratchett?
The Magician's Assistant, as I say, is my favourite one, and it deals a lot with grief, and that resonates very deeply with me. But Commonwealth is another one that I think is probably her best novel, and it, the tangle of family relationships that she describes, you get to understand each strand of this incredibly knotty family relationship, and how people grow into the adults that they become from the childhoods that they've had. And at the same time, it's extremely entertaining, it's humorous, it's fun to read. It's not one I always terrified when people say you must read this, it's gut-wrenching. I don't really want my guts to be wrenched, but I do want to be touched deeply. And she does that just with this lightness of touch that I was saying that Jane Austen has, that the writers that I admire really have, so that it's so hard to see the seams. It's so hard to see how they're doing it because you are just taken along with it.
And Jackie, so you mentioned the Priory of the Orange Tree and Life mm-hmm. After Life. They're quite different books.
Very different books.
How do they influence your work, or how are they reflected in your writing?
Okay. I mean, inevitably, where fantasy is concerned, with Samantha Shannon's work, it's the world building. It's the credibility of the world. But also, it's that whole thing. I mean, she really does research her work. I mean, does tons and tons of research. But then what I love about it is that, you know, and I've read other fantasy books where literally you know that person's researched, you know, and really built their world. But it's that whole sense of show, don't tell. And I think with Samantha Shannon's work, literally you just get immersed into the world. You forget about the fact that, you know, this author's probably done so much research into every single element of it to make it real. Whereas with other fantasy writers, you sort of like get that sense of, okay, this is like an information dump. It's that whole sense of, you know, you've done all this research, so therefore, and built this world, so therefore, here it is. But, you know, in a very unsubtle way. But with Samantha Shannon's work, it's always that sense of, it is so she's done it so well and built the world so well that you don't even question it. You're completely and totally and utterly immersed in it. And I think, again, I mean, I think similarly in terms of historical fiction, because again, there's a huge element of world building there. Even though we might be familiar with the world, you still need to make it credible. You still need to make it, you know, immersive. And I think that's exactly what, you know, it's like Kate Atkinson always achieves, really. There's never that question of, you know, it's all very authentic and it just like draws you in and pulls you in. So in that respect, definitely, and I hope I just say again, it's like that. Obviously, you know, for my own world building, I've had to do a lot of sort of like research and just imagining and stuff. And I hope that I have created as immersive and as credible worlds as I don't know where I will never be able to get to that point of Samantha Shannon's. And certainly, you know, I'd love to write epic fantasy, but I don't know whether I could because of just the, how humongous it totally is. But yeah, I mean, it's that, it's the world building really credible worlds and characters.
Yeah. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, everyone. So thank you, Kia, Kate, Jackie, Cindy, for sharing your much loved reads. It's just a really varied and eclectic mix and very, very thought-provoking. So I'll take a lot away from that.
Yeah, it's great to hear these recommendations, isn't it? They're going. I've got some new things to put on my to-be-read file. So, thank you for updating us on your writing as well. It's always inspiring to hear what Circle members are working on in some depth. And we get so much from hearing about it. So thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone. Thank you. Welcome to the podcast, author and Circle member Samuel Burr and his editor Charlotte Mercel, publishing director at Orion. It's very special to have you both with us.
Thank you so much.
Welcome.
Very exciting.
Sam, we'd love it that you make it down from London to be part of our community, and we really value your contribution to the group. You bring a certain light.
So we're here talking about your debut novel, The Fellowship of the Puzzle Makers, which is out on May 9th and available for pre-order and to buy at all good bookshops, Waterstones and Amazon. The book has been described as uplifting, a ripping yarn, joyous, nostalgic and warm. Tell us, Sam, what's it about?
Well, The Fellowship of Puzzle Makers is the story of a young man called Clayton Stumper. He is a young man that's sort of grown old before he's grown up. So he dresses like your granddad and drinks sherry like your aunt. And he's 25 years old. He finds himself in quite a unique situation of being one of the last surviving members of a very British institution, which is this extraordinary place, the Fellowship. Here we have some of the smartest, most brilliant minds in the country. We've got a maze maker, a quiz setter, a jigsaw artist, to name just a few. But there's a mystery at the heart of the Fellowship, a sort of puzzle that's yet to be solved, and that is how Clayton came to be there. He isn't a puzzle maker himself. He was abandoned at birth on the steps. So during the book, we follow Clayton on his quest to sort of piece together the clues of his past and find himself at the same time.
Sounds brilliant. Would you mind sharing a bit with us?
Of course. Now I'm going to be reading from my, this is the first time I've done this, and I'm reading from, I don't know if you can see, but I'm doing it from my very nice proof, which has a lovely cutout on the cover.
So for people who can't see, Sam's book has a beautiful sky blue cover, and there is a jigsaw piece cut out into the hardcover front, and it reveals a illustrated front page inside. It's absolutely gorgeous. That is stunning.
It isn't it? And I have to wrap it. I've got it wrapped in bubble wrap and newspaper because it's the only copy I've got and I just don't want to damage it. But I've got it out for this very moment to read. So I'm very excited. This is the prologue. Prologue, 1993. The shiny brass plaque affixed to the front door was plain gobbledygook to some. But for many who visited this grand house on the outskirts of Bedfordshire, and certainly for the people who resided here, it made perfect sense. It was a basic plus 11 Caesar shift, nothing too fiendish at all. Welcome to the Fellowship of Puzzle Makers. Beneath it, a laminated slip of paper read, "Our buzzer is playing up. Press and hold it, else it sounds like Morse code. Better still, try the knocker. one of us is usually in. Pippa Osbrook stood with her back to the house and felt her entire weight collapse against the arched oaken door. She pulled it shut the moment she'd stepped outside and clocked the peculiar delivery on the front steps, which had appeared almost out of thin air. A hat box. It looked just like any other with its black leather exterior, gold trim and the letters HH embossed in gold on the hexagonal lid. But it was the contents, or more specifically the noise coming from the thing, that really confounded her. An insistently high-pitched, piercing sound that up close really couldn't be confused with anything else at all. As Pippa removed the lid, which had been left deliberately unsecured, she was so overcome her legs started to buckle. She reached the pillar of the porch to steady herself and folded her spare hand against her pounding chest, stealing another glimpse inside. Surely not. Tucked inside the flowery paper lining of the box, a beautiful little baby, presumably no more than a few days old, was swaddled in a custard yellow blanket, crying its heart out. "Oh, my darling, where the devil have you come from?" The boy's squalling briefly tempered as Pippa peered down at him, their eyes meeting. "Aren't you just the most beautiful little thing?" She wasn't used to throwing out such airy blandishments, but the tiny little person looking up at her, a boy if the blue of his romper suit was anything to go by, was perfect in every way imaginable. He had golden wisps of hair whipped on his head like spun sugar, cheeks as plump as a pudding, and the palest blue eyes, so piercing they seemed to penetrate her own. Pippa gathered up her tweed skirt and crouched down on the steps. She reached gingerly inside the box. First, she wiped away the silvery trail of tears. Then she stroked her thumb along the tiny boy's nose before bopping it once, twice, three times, as if checking he were real, that this wasn't all a dream. "Boop," she heard herself say in a light sing-song voice. The baby, soothed by the gesture, went very still for a moment. She looked at him, he looked at her. She felt his tiny hands curl around her finger before his flailing arms suddenly shot upwards. He was reaching out for her. She tucked one hand carefully under his head and the other beneath his back without hesitating and hoisted him out of the box. "Shh now," she whispered gently in his ear. "I've got you." He was so unbearably soft she couldn't help but press their two faces together. With his velvety skin brushing against hers, Pippa issued a breath. She kissed him on the head, his nose, the tiny dimple of his chin. He smelled like the inside of a milk bottle, or freshly baked bread, and imperial leather. It was only when she nestled the baby boy into the crook of her arm that she caught it. There, in the dense shrubbery either side of the long gravel drive, was a definite flash of something ahead of her. A scampering. It wasn't the faint scuttle of an animal, nor the wind rustling the branches, but a human movement somewhere in the distance. She was sure of it. Someone was out there. Someone was watching. "Step forward," she wanted to say. "Tell me who you are, why you're leaving this baby with us." But just then, the baby's tiny little fist reached out and wrapped around her middle finger, and she knew in that moment that their fates were sealed. "That's it," she murmured soothingly, gently rocking the boy from side to side in the dappled morning light. Their two pulses were beginning to settle into each other. "You're safe now." For Pippa Osbrook, in all her 67 years on this earth, there had never been a moment as miraculous nor utterly fated as this one. It was the solution she spent a lifetime searching for, the missing piece.
That was beautiful.
Oh my goodness.
I've never read that before. I've never read it out loud.
Oh, it's a wonderful day you read it, Sam.
Yeah.
That was gorgeous. Oh, thank, that was a real treat. Thank you so much.
I've got all the feels. My God, I want that book.
And honestly, I was welling up.
God, it's so visceral.
So my question is for you, Charlotte. So you're Sam's editor at Orion.
I am.
Could you explain to us a little bit about exactly what an editor does and why you wanted to work on this particular book?
Absolutely. My role as an editor is, well, largely I'm sent a lot of books by brilliant agents every week. And it's my job to find the ones that I feel really, really passionate about and then hopefully acquire them. And then, of course, from that that stage on, you become the champion of that book in-house, and your role switches from editor when you are, I worked very closely with Sam, sort of editing the story and making it hopefully the best it can possibly be, and then ultimately publishing the book and in charge of the campaign for it. In terms of why Sam's book, I mean, I'm sure everyone is convinced just from hearing the prologue being read just now, but I had exactly the same reaction. It's very rare that a book comes along where from the first few pages or even the first few lines, you know, as an editor that you have to publish it. And you know that if you don't manage to acquire it, your heart will be broken and you'll have to sort of hide yourself from the publishing for the next few years so you don't see anyone else publishing it. But it was the same with Sam's book. Within a few hours of the book landing in editors' inboxes across the industry, there were preempts on the table. We then went swiftly to an eight-way auction run by Helly Ogden at WME, who is Sam's agent. And then we basically paraded ourselves in a beauty contest to try and make Sam pick us, which involved many things, including within our pitch, we actually tracked down a puzzle. Well, actually, it was a hat box that we tried to woo Sam with, which is what obviously the baby is discovered in at the start of the story. So we were trying to pull all the tricks out of the box to convince him to go with us. And thankfully, he did.
And the theme of our podcast is favourite books. So I'm very intrigued to ask you, Sam, what is your favourite book or books, and how that might have inspired your writing and possibly even the Fellowship of the Puzzle Makers?
Well, it's a incredibly difficult question. I've decided to do is pick a book that is one of my favourites, and it's a book that I've recommended, I think, more than any other. And I think that's quite interesting. Sometimes when you finish a book, you just really desperately want to share it with others. The book that I would love to recommend as one of my favorites is called We All Want Impossible Things by Catherine Newman. It is kind of an extraordinary book in that ostensibly it's a book about dying. Mm-hmm. And yet it is one of the funniest books I've read in a very, very long time. I sort of have a little journal that I keep now for when I'm reading books, just to leave a couple of notes of like what I've read and what I liked about it. And I looked back at my journal to see what I'd written for this book, and I just put, it's the funniest, saddest book I've ever read. Mm-hmm. So it's about two friends, Edie and Ash. There's a line in it that I loved as well, which was Edie's memory is like the backup hard drive for mine. So Edie and Ash are kind of inseparable as two best friends. And I think what I loved most about it is a book that's about dying. You know, there's a version of this book that could be really, really atrocious and really, you know, I don't know, it could just be overly sentimental and cloying. But this book the tone of it and the way that she's judged the writing is so perfect. It is never ever sentimental. It's always real. It's sort of bittersweet, and I think that in terms of what I love to read, I love books that can do that, that can make me laugh and then make me cry. I'm in awe of writers that can do that. So I think that would be my book that I would recommend.
Has it influenced your writing, do you think?
I read this recently, and I'd say it was probably while I was doing the final stages of the edits. I think it will inspire maybe even book two, but I'm someone that I think that is my ambition, is to do that sort of bittersweet writing, the stories that are entertaining and don't feel like homework, but will move you at the same time. That's always what I'm sort of seeking to do with my writing, but Catherine Newman does it just perfectly in this book. And I highly, highly recommend it. Don't be put off by the on the surface what the story is about, because it's a lot funnier than you might expect.
Great. I've made a note.
Yes.
So Charlotte, can you tell us a little bit about your favourite book and why? And my follow-up question to that will be, does your choice impact the kind of books you're looking to acquire or work on?
Yeah, well, I think similar to Sam, I struggle to pick a favourite book because I think it's so dependent on what age you are and what mood you're in at the time. So I'm going to do a similar thing. And I think one book that's really stood out to me in the last year is it's actually just won the Waterstones debut prize. And it's In Memoriam by Alice Wynne. And I think it's absolutely phenomenal. Very sort of unexpected. It's the story of two young men at the start of World War One. They're only 17, 18 years old, and it follows them as the war breaks out. And I am bereft now that I finished it. I'm also slightly relieved that I finished it because I felt like I went on such a journey with them. It's you know, as harrowing as you might imagine, but so full of love and hope in there. It's just honestly one of the most wonderful books I've read, so I couldn't praise that more highly. But in terms of how it affects what I'm acquiring, I think as an editor, no would be my answer. But I think one of the most exciting things as an editor is when you go to your team and you say to them, this is like nothing I've ever read before. That is when you know you found something really, really special. And I think that's the feeling I had with Sam's book as well. And what Sam hasn't told you is he's also a bit of a puzzle genius, and every chapter, or actually within the chapters themselves, you get a crossword puzzle or a maze or a word search. We both have had to become quite accomplished at puzzle completion over the course of this story, but that for me is something I've never seen done before. And you as the reader can complete them as you go through the story, and it reveals a sort of clue to our protagonist Clayton's journey, which is all I'll say on that matter. But you need a pen in hand as you do Sam's book. Of course, it can be read without one if you're not into that, but it's amazing.
That sounds absolutely incredible. Thank you both so much for coming on the podcast to talk to us about your favorite books, and of course the Fellowship of the Puzzle Makers. That's so exciting. Congratulations, Sam.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
So, Sam, where can we find you and keep up with the Puzzle Makers and your writing?
I am on Twitter, or X as it's now called, and Instagram. And it's just my name. So it's at Samuel Burr, SamuelBurr. And yeah, there's lots of information as well about the book on the Orion Books social pages as well.
Okay. Well, having heard your reading, I mean, even the title alone is enough to sort of inspire a certain feeling. But having heard the reading, I can feel an obsession already building. You can tell it's a really well-edited book, and I think you're going to have quite a few people following you. The reaction has already been amazing amongst your writer's circle, and we are absolutely cheering you on. So thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you both, Sam and Charlotte, for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As our Real Writers Circle takeover of Brighton Book Club comes to an end, we've talked about work from an incredible range of authors, from Agatha Christie to Gerald Dahl, from Arundhati Roy to Gabrielle Zevin, and we've learned that as a writing circle, our tastes and influences are very broad. We'd like to thank Anna for having us on the show. We love you and are so grateful to you for this opportunity. And thank you, Brighton Book Club listeners, for spending time with us. We've had a blast. And if you're interested in learning more about Real Writers Circle, you can find us at www.realwriterscircle.com. We'd love to hear from you.
So we'd like to close with a quote from one of my favourite books selected on this podcast, Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking. And here's the quote. Life changes fast. Life changes in the instant. You sit down to dinner and life as you know it ends. These are the first words I wrote after it happened. For a long time, I wrote nothing else. Life changes in the instant, the ordinary instant. All of which said by Joan Didion. And I'd like to say to everybody now, goodbye.
I can't tell you how nice it is to sit back and listen to Cindy and Victoria and their wonderful guests, and really hope you enjoyed listening to the Real Writers Circle takeover as much as I loved listening to it. We will be back next month with a very special Brighton bestseller episode featuring the wonderful Brighton-based authors Ellie Griffiths, Dorothy Coombson and Jack Jordan. You can keep up to date with us over on Instagram at BTN Book Club, and you can stay in touch by email at btnbookclub@gmail.com. The show is available as a podcast, which you can download from wherever you get yours. And if you do, please rate, review and subscribe, and tell your book loving friends. We love new listeners. Thank you so much for listening, and do check out the Real Writers Circle. They are an absolutely amazing group of writers, and their events are the highlight of my month. So if you're a writer, a book lover, a reader in Brighton, please do look them up. Thank you so much for listening.